Gertie Gartler was seeing between cell lines was just the effect of spontaneous transformation making all cells act the same. Eventually, Robert Stevenson of the Cell Culture Collection Committee spoke up, saying, "It looks like more detective work is needed to see whether we are going to have to start all over again to isolate some new human cell lines." Xu stepped in and said, "I would like to give particular priority to those who initiated the cell lines, whom Dr. Gartler has attacked. If there is any defense, we would like to hear it." Harvard's Robert Chang, whose widely used Chang liver cell line was listed as a HeLa contaminant on Gartler's chart, glared from his seat. Chang had used those cells to discover enzymes and genes specific to liver cells. If Gartler was right, and the cells were actually from Henrietta's cervix, Chang's liver research using them was worthless. Leonard Hayflick had an especially personal connection with his cell line, Wish, which Gartler had listed as contaminated. He'd grown it using cells from the amniotic sac in which his unborn daughter had once floated. He asked Gartler whether it was possible to find G6PDA in samples from white people. "Caucasian subjects with G6PDA have not been reported," Gartler told him. Later that day, in a talk chaired by George Guy, Hayflick delivered a paper on The Facts and Theories of Spontaneous Transformation of Cells in Culture. Before beginning his talk, Hayflick stood at the podium and announced that since Wish cells supposedly tested positive for a genetic marker found only in black people, he called his wife during the break to ask if he was, in fact, his daughter's father. "She assured me that my worst fears were unfounded," Hayflick said. The room erupted in laughter, and no one said anything else publicly about Gartler's findings. But a few people took Gartler seriously. Before leaving the conference, Stevenson met several of the top cell culturalists for lunch. He told them to go back to their labs after the conference and start testing cells for the G6PDA genetic marker to see how widespread this problem might be. Many of their cell lines tested positive, including the skin cells George Hyatt had transplanted onto a soldier's arm years earlier. Since Hyatt had no HeLa cells in his lab at the time, the cells in his experiment must have been contaminated before they arrived. And though few realized it, the same thing was happening in laboratories around the world. Still, many scientists refused to believe HeLa contamination was real. After the conference, where Gartler dropped what became known as the HeLa bomb, most researchers kept right on working with the cells he'd said were contaminated. But Stevenson and a few other scientists realized the potential scope of the HeLa contamination problem. So they began working to develop genetic tests that could specifically identify HeLa cells in culture instead of just testing for the presence of G6PDA. And those genetic tests would eventually lead them to Henrietta's family. Chapter 21, Night Doctors, 2000. 2 months after Sonny Lack stood me up, I sat waiting for him again, this time in the lobby of the Baltimore Holiday Inn. It was New Year's Day, and he was nearly 2 hours late. I figured he'd backed out again, so I started packing to leave. Then I heard a man's voice yell, "So you're Miss Rebecca?" Suddenly, Sonny was standing beside me with a sweet and bashful gap-toothed grin that made him look like a 50-year-old teenager. He laughed and patted me on the back. "You just won't give up, will you?" he said. "I got to tell you, only person I know more hard-headed than you is my sister, Dale." He grinned and straightened his black driving cap. "I tried to convince her to come meet you today, but she won't listen." Sonny had a loud laugh and mischievous eyes that squinted nearly closed when he smiled. His face was warm and handsome, open to the world. He was thin, 5'9" at most, with a carefully manicured mustache. He reached for my bag. "Okay, then," he said. "We best get this thing going." I followed him to a Volvo he'd left unlocked and idling in the parking lot next to the hotel. He'd borrowed it from one of his daughters. "Nobody wants to ride in my raggedy old van," he said, easing the car into gear. "You ready to go see the big kahuna?"
"The big kahuna?"
"Yep," he said, grinning. "Deborah says you got to talk to our brother Lawrence before anybody else talked to you. He'll check you out, decide what's what. If he say it's okay, then maybe the rest of us will talk to you."
We drove in silence for several blocks.
"Lawrence is the only one of us kids who remembers our mother," Sonny said eventually. "Deborah and I don't know nothing about her."
Then, without looking from the road, Sonny told me everything he knew about his mother.
"Everybody say she was real nice and cooked good," he said. "Pretty, too. Her cells have been blowed up in nuclear bombs. From her cells came all these different creations. Medical miracles, like polio vaccines, some cure for cancer and other things. Even AIDS. She liked taking care of people. So it makes sense what she did with them cells. I mean, people always say she was really just hospitality, you know? Fixing everything up nice, making a good place, get up, cook breakfast for everybody, even if it's 20 of them.
He pulled into an empty alley behind a row of red brick townhouses and looked at me for the first time since we'd gotten in the car.
"This is where we take scientists and reporters wanting to know about our mother. It's where the family gangs up on them," he said, laughing. "But you seem nice, so I'll do you a favor and not go get my brother Zakaria this time."
I got out of the car, and Sonny drove away yelling,
"Good luck!"
out the window. All I knew about Sonny's brothers was that they were angry and one of them had murdered someone. I wasn't sure which one or why. A few months earlier, when Deborah gave me Lawrence's phone number and swore she'd never talk to me, she'd said,
"Brother gets mad when white folks come asking about our mother."
As I walked through a narrow half-cement yard from the alley to Lawrence's house, a wisp of smoke seeped through the screen door of his kitchen, where static blared from a small television on a folding table. I knocked, then waited. Nothing. I stuck my head into the kitchen, where fat pork chops sat burning on the stove. I yelled hello. Still nothing. I took a deep breath and walked inside. As I closed the door behind me, Lawrence appeared, seeming bigger than two of me, his 275-pound, 6-foot frame spanning the width of the narrow kitchen, one hand on the counter, the other on the opposite wall.
"Well, hello there, Miss Rebecca," he said, giving me a once-over. "You want to taste the meat I cooked?"
It had been a decade or so since I'd eaten pork, but suddenly that seemed irrelevant. "How could I resist?" I said. A sweet grin spread across Lawrence's face. He was 64, but aside from his gray curls, he seemed decades younger, with smooth hazelnut brown skin and youthful brown eyes. He hiked up his baggy blue jeans, wiped his hands on his grease-stained T-shirt, and clapped.
"Okay, then," he said. "That's good. That's real good. I'm gonna fry you up some eggs, too. You're too damn skinny."
While he cooked, Lawrence talked about life down in the country.
"When older folks went to town to sell tobacco, they'd come back with a piece of bologna for us kids to share. And sometimes, if we were good, they let us sop up the bacon grease with a piece of bread."
His memory for detail was impressive. He drew pictures of the horse-drawn wagon Day had made out of 2x4s. He showed me, with string and napkins, how he tied tobacco into bundles for drying when he was a child. But when I asked about his mother, Lawrence fell silent. Eventually, he said, "She was pretty." Then he went back to talking about tobacco. I asked about Henrietta again, and he said, "My father and his friends used to race horses up and down Lexington Road." We went in circles like this until he sighed and told me he didn't remember his mother. In fact, he said, he didn't remember most of his teen years.
"I blacked it out of my mind because of the sadness and hurtin'," he told me,
and he had no intention of unblocking it.
"The only memory I have about my mother is her being strict," he told me.
He remembered her making him hand-wash diapers in the sink. He'd hang them to dry, then she'd dump them back in the water, saying they weren't clean enough. But the only times she whipped him were for swimming off the pier in Turner Station.
"She'd make me go fetch a switch to get it beaten with, then send me back out saying to get a bigger one, then a bigger one. Then she'd wrap all them together and haul off on my tail."
As he talked, the kitchen filled with smoke again. We'd both forgotten he was cooking. Lawrence shooed me from the kitchen table into the living room, where he sat me in front of a plastic Christmas placemat with a plate of fried eggs and a chunk of charred pork the size of my hand, only thicker. Then he collapsed into a wooden chair beside me, put his elbows on his knees, and stared at the floor in silence while I ate.
"You're writing a book about my mama," he said finally.
I nodded as I chewed.
"Her cells growing big as the world, cover around the whole earth," he said,
his eyes tearing as he waved his arms in the air, making a planet around him.
"That's kind of weird. They're just steady growing and growing, steady fighting off whatever they're fighting off."
He leaned forward in his chair, his face inches from mine, and whispered,
"You know what I heard? I heard by the year 2050, babies will be injected with serum made from my mama's cells so they can live to 800 years old."
He gave me a smile like, "I bet your mama can't top that."
"They're going to get rid of disease," he said. "They're a miracle."
Lawrence fell back in his chair and stared into his lap, his smile collapsing. After a long, quiet moment, he turned and looked into my eyes.
"Can you tell me what my mama's cells really did?" he whispered. "I know they did something important, but nobody tells us nothing."
When I asked if he knew what a cell was, he stared at his feet as if I'd called on him in class and he hadn't done his homework.
"Kinda," he said. "Not really."
I tore a piece of paper from my notebook, drew a big circle with a small black dot inside, and explained what a cell was, then told him some of the things Hila had done for science and how far cell culture had come since. "Scientists can even grow corneas now," I told him, reaching into my bag for an article I'd clipped from a newspaper. I handed it to him and told him that using culturing techniques Hila helped develop, scientists could now take a sample of someone's cornea, grow it in culture, then transplant it into someone else's eye to help treat blindness.
"Imagine that,"
Lawrence said, shaking his head.
"It's a miracle."
Suddenly, Sonny threw open the screen door, yelling,
"Miss Rebecca still alive in here?"
He leaned in the doorway between the kitchen and the living room.
"Looks like you passed the test,"
he said, pointing at my half-empty plate.
"Miss Rebecca telling me about our mother's cells,"
Lawrence said.
"She told me fascinating stuff. Did you know our mother's cells gonna be used to make Stevie Wonder see?"
"Oh, well, actually, it's not her cells being put into people's eyes," I said, stammering. "Scientists are using technology her cells helped develop to grow other people's corneas."
"That's a miracle," Sonny said. "I didn't know about that. But the other day, President Clinton said the polio vaccine is one of the most important things that happened in the 20th century. And her cells involved with that, too." That's a miracle, Lawrence said.
So is this,
Sonny said, slowly spreading his arms and stepping aside to reveal his 84-year-old father, Day, teetering on unsteady legs behind him. Day hadn't left the house in nearly a week because of a nosebleed that wouldn't stop. Now, he stood in the doorway in faded jeans, a flannel shirt, and blue plastic flip-flops, even though it was January. He was thin and frail, barely able to hold himself upright. His light brown face had grown tough with age, cracked but soft, like a pair of well-worn work boots. His silver hair was covered with a black driving cap identical to Sonny's.
He's got the gangrene in his feet, Sonny said, pointing to Day's toes, which were several shades darker than the rest of him and covered with open sores. His feet hurt too much in regular shoes.
Gangrene was spreading from Day's toes to his knee. His doctor said his toes needed amputating, but Day refused. He said he didn't want doctors cutting on him, like they did Henrietta. At 52, Sonny felt the same way. His doctor said he needed angioplasty, but he swore he'd never do it. Day sat beside me, brown plastic sunglasses shading his constantly tearing eyes.
Daddy, Lawrence yelled, did you know Mama Cell's gonna make Stevie Wonder see?
Day shook his head in what looked like slow motion.
Nope, he mumbled. Didn't know that till just now. Don't surprise me none, though.
Then there was a thump on the ceiling and the rustling of someone walking around, and Lawrence jumped from the table and ran into the kitchen.
My wife is a fire dragon without morning coffee, he said. I better make some.
It was 2 in the afternoon. A few minutes later, Babette Lax walked down the stairs and through the living room slowly, wearing a faded blue terry cloth robe. Everyone stopped talking as she passed and headed into the kitchen without saying a word or looking at anyone. Babette seemed like a loud person being quiet, like a woman with an enormous laugh and temper who might erupt with either at any moment. She exuded, "Don't mess with me," her face stern and staring straight ahead. She knew why I was there and had plenty to say on the subject, but seemed utterly exhausted at the idea of talking to me, yet another white person wanting something from the family. She disappeared into the kitchen, and Sonny slid a crumpled piece of paper into Day's hand, a printout of the picture of Henrietta with her hands on her hips. He grabbed my tape recorder from the center of the table, handed it to Day, and said,
Okay. Miss Rebecca got questions for you, Pop. Tell her what you know.
Day took the recorder from Sonny's hand and said nothing.
She just want to know everything Dale always asking you about, Sonny said.
I asked Sonny if maybe he could call Deborah to see if she'd come over, and the Lax men shook their heads, laughing.
Dale don't want to talk to nobody right now, Sonny said. That's 'cause she tired of it, Day grumbled. They always asking questions and things. She keep giving out information and not getting nothing. They don't even give her a postcard. Yep, Sonny said. That's right. All they wants to do is know everything. And that's what Miss Rebecca wants, too. So go on, Daddy. Tell her. Just get this over with.
But Day didn't want to talk about Henrietta's life.
First I heard about it was she had that cancer, he said,
repeating the story he'd told dozens of reporters over the years, almost verbatim.
Hopkins called me, said, come up there, 'cause she died. They asked me to let them have Henrietta, and I told them no. I said, I don't know what you did, but you killed her. Don't keep cutting on her. But after a time, my cousin said it wouldn't hurt none, so I said okay.
Day clenched his 3 remaining teeth.
I didn't sign no papers, he said. I just told them they could do autopsy,
Nothing else. Them doctors never said nothing about keeping her alive in no tubes or growing no cells. All they told me was they wanted to do autopsy, see if they could help my children. And I've always just knowed this much. They is the doctor, and you got to go by what they say. I don't know as much as they do. And them doctors said if I gave them my old lady, they could use her to study that cancer and maybe help my children, my grandchildren. Yeah, Sonny yelled. They said it would help his kids in case they come down with cancer. He had 5 kids. What was he gonna do? They knew them cells was already growing when I come down there after she died, Day said, shaking his head. But they didn't tell me nothing about that. They just asked if they could cut her up, see about that cancer. Well, what do you expect from Hopkins? Bobette yelled from the kitchen, where she sat watching a soap opera. I wouldn't even go there to get my toenails cut. Mm-hmm, Day yelled back, thumping his silver cane on the floor like an exclamation point. Back then, they did things, Sonny said, especially to black folks. John Hopkins was known for experimenting on black folks. They'd snatch 'em off the street. That's right, Bobette said, appearing in the kitchen door with her coffee. Everybody knows that. They just snatch 'em off the street, Sonny said. Snatching people, Bobette yelled, her voice growing louder. Experimenting on them, Sonny yelled. You'd be surprised how many people disappeared in East Baltimore when I was a girl, Bobette said, shaking her head. I'm telling you, I lived here in the 50s when they got Henrietta, and we weren't allowed to go anywhere near Hopkins. When it got dark and we were young, we had to be on the steps, or Hopkins might get us. The Laxes aren't the only ones who heard from a young age that Hopkins and other hospitals abducted black people. Since at least the 1800s, black oral history has been filled with tales of night doctors who kidnapped black people for research. And there were disturbing truths behind those stories. Some of the stories were conjured by white plantation owners taking advantage of the long-held African belief that ghosts cause disease and death. To discourage slaves from meeting or escaping, slave owners told tales of gruesome research done on black bodies, then covered themselves in white sheets and crept around at night, posing as spirits coming to infect black people with disease or steal them for research. Those sheets eventually gave rise to the white hooded cloaks of the Ku Klux Klan. But night doctors weren't just fictions conjured as scare tactics. Many doctors tested drugs on slaves and operated on them to develop new surgical techniques, often without using anesthesia. Fear of night doctors only increased in the early 1900s as black people migrated north to Washington, D.C. and Baltimore, and news spread that medical schools there were offering money in exchange for bodies. Black corpses were routinely exhumed from graves for research, and an underground shipping industry kept schools in the north supplied with black bodies from the south for anatomy courses. The bodies sometimes arrived, a dozen or so at a time, in barrels labeled turpentine. Because of this history, black residents near Hopkins have long believed the hospital was built in a poor black neighborhood for the benefit of scientists, to give them easy access to potential research subjects. In fact, it was built for the benefit of Baltimore's poor. Johns Hopkins was born on a tobacco plantation in Maryland, where his father later freed his slaves nearly 60 years before emancipation. Hopkins made millions working as a banker and grocer, and selling his own brand of whiskey. But he never married and had no children. So in 1873, not long before his death, he donated $7 million to start a medical school and charity hospital. He wrote a letter to the 12 men he'd chosen to serve as its board of trustees, outlining his wishes. In it,
he explained that the purpose of Hopkins Hospital was to help those who otherwise couldn't get medical care. The indigent sick of this city and its environs, without regard to sex, age, or color, who require surgical or medical treatment, and who can be received into the hospital without peril to other inmates, and the poor of the city and state, of all races, who are stricken down by any casualty, shall be received into the hospital without charge. He specified that the only patients to be charged were those who could easily afford it, and that any money they brought in should then be spent treating those without money. He also set aside an additional $2 million worth of property and $20,000 in cash each year specifically for helping black children. It will be your duty hereafter to provide suitable buildings for the reception, maintenance, and education of orphaned colored children. I direct you to provide accommodations for 300 or 400 children of this class. You are also authorized to receive into this asylum at your discretion, as belonging to such class, colored children who have lost one parent only, and, in exceptional cases, to receive colored children who are not orphans, but may be in such circumstances as to require the aid of charity. Hopkins died not long after writing that letter. His board of trustees, many of them friends and family, created one of the top medical schools in the country, and a hospital whose public wards provided millions of dollars in free care to the poor, many of them black. But the history of Hopkins Hospital certainly isn't pristine when it comes to black patients. In 1969, a Hopkins researcher used blood samples from more than 7,000 neighborhood children, most of them from poor black families, to look for a genetic predisposition to criminal behavior. The researcher didn't get consent. The American Civil Liberties Union filed suit claiming the study violated the boy's civil rights and breached confidentiality of doctor-patient relationships by releasing results to state and juvenile courts. The study was halted, then resumed a few months later using consent forms. In the late 90s, two women sued Hopkins, claiming that its researchers had knowingly exposed their children to lead and hadn't promptly informed them when blood tests revealed that their children had elevated lead levels, even when one developed lead poisoning. The research was part of a study examining lead abatement methods, and all families involved were black. The researchers had treated several homes to varying degrees, then encouraged landlords to rent those homes to families with children so they could then monitor the children's lead levels. Initially, the case was dismissed. On appeal, one judge compared the study to Southam's HeLa injections, the Tuskegee study, and Nazi research, and the case eventually settled out of court. The Department of Health and Human Services launched an investigation and concluded that the study's consent forms failed to provide an adequate description of the different levels of lead abatement in the homes. But today, when people talk about the history of Hopkins's relationship with the black community, the story many of them hold up as the worst offense is that of Henrietta Lacks, a black woman whose body, they say, was exploited by white scientists. Sitting in Lawrence's living room, Sonny and Babette yelled back and forth for nearly an hour about Hopkins snatching black people. Eventually, Sonny leaned back in his chair and said, "John Hopkins didn't give us no information about anything. That was the bad part. Not the sad part, but the bad part. 'Cause I don't know if they didn't give us information because they was making money out of it, or if they was just wanting to keep us in the dark about it. I think they made money out of it because they were selling her cells all over the world and shipping them for dollars." "Hopkins say they gave them cells away," Lawrence yelled, "but they made millions. It's not fair. She's the most important person in the world and her family living in poverty. If our mother's so important to science,
Why can't we get health insurance?
Day had prostate cancer and asbestos-filled lungs. Sonny had a bad heart, and Deborah had arthritis, osteoporosis, nerve deafness, anxiety, and depression. With all that, plus the whole family's high blood pressure and diabetes, the Laxes figured they pretty much supported the pharmaceutical industry, plus several doctors. But their insurance came and went. Some were covered through Medicare, others on and off by spouses. But they all went stretches with no coverage or money for treatment. As the Lax man talked about Hopkins and insurance, Babette snorted in disgust and walked to her recliner in the living room.
My pressure's going up, and I'm not going to die over this, you know?
The whole thing just wasn't worth getting riled up over, she said. But she couldn't help herself.
Everybody knew black people were disappearing 'cause Hopkins was experimenting on them, she yelled. I believe a lot of it was true.
Probably so, Sonny said. A lot might have been a myth, too. You never know.
But one thing we do know. Them cells about my mother ain't no myth.
Day thumped his cane again.
You know what is a myth?
Babette snapped from the recliner.
Everybody always saying Henrietta Lacks donated those cells. She didn't donate nothing. They took them and didn't ask.
She inhaled a deep breath to calm herself.
What really would upset Henrietta is the fact that Dr. Guy never told the family anything. We didn't know nothing about those cells, and he didn't care. That just rubbed us the wrong way. I just kept asking everybody, why didn't they say anything to the family? They knew how to contact us. If Dr. Guy wasn't dead, I think I would have killed him myself.
Chapter 22. The Fame She So Richly Deserves. 1970 to 1973. One afternoon in the late spring of 1970, George Guy stood in his favorite waders on the bank of the Potomac River, where he and several other Hopkins researchers had been fishing together every Wednesday for years. Suddenly, Guy was so exhausted he could hardly hold his fishing rod. His buddies dragged him up the embankment to the white Jeep he'd bought using money from a cancer research award. Soon after that fishing trip, at the age of 71, Guy learned he had the disease he'd spent his entire life trying to fight, and he had one of its most deadly forms, pancreatic cancer. If doctors didn't operate, Guy knew he would die within months. If they did, it might buy him a little time, or it might not. On August 8, 1970, around 6 a.m., Margaret called each member of the Guy Lab's staff, including a postdoctoral student who'd just flown in on a red-eye from Europe. Come down to the lab as fast as you can, she told them. There's going to be an emergency procedure this morning. She didn't tell them what that procedure would be. Before going into the operating room, George told his surgeons that he wanted them to take samples of his tumor, just as Dr. Wharton had done with Henrietta's tumor decades earlier. Guy gave his lab staff careful instructions for growing GG, a line of cancer cells taken from his pancreas. He hoped that his cells, like Henrietta's, would become immortal. Work all day and night if you have to, he told his postdocs and assistants. Make this happen. Soon, with Guy anesthetized on the operating table, surgeons opened him up and found that the cancer was inoperable. Growths covered his stomach, spleen, liver, and intestines. They worried that cutting into the cancer might kill him. Despite Guy's wishes, they sewed him up without taking any samples. When he awoke from anesthesia and found out there would be no GG line, he was furious. If this cancer was going to kill him, he wanted it to help advance science in the process. As soon as he'd recovered enough from his surgery to travel,
Guy began contacting cancer researchers around the country, asking who was doing research on pancreatic cancer and needed a patient to experiment on. He was flooded with replies, some from scientists he didn't know, others from friends and colleagues. In the 3 months between his surgery and his death, Guy went to the Mayo Clinic in Minneapolis for a week of treatments with an experimental Japanese drug that made him violently ill. His son, George Jr., who had just finished medical school, sat with Guy through the whole thing and made sure he had a freshly pressed suit each day. After leaving the Mayo Clinic, Guy spent several days in New York City at Sloan Kettering for another study, and he underwent chemotherapy at Hopkins using a drug not yet approved for use in humans. Guy was 6.5 feet tall and about 215 pounds when he was diagnosed, but he withered quickly. He often doubled over from the abdominal pain. He vomited constantly, and the treatments soon left him confined to a wheelchair. But he continued showing up at the lab and writing letters to his colleagues. At some point, not long before his death, he told his former assistant, Mary Kupacek, that it was fine to release Henrietta's name if anyone asked, since it had been so many years. But Mary never told a soul. George Guy died on November 8, 1970. A few months after Guy's death, Howard Jones and several Hopkins colleagues, including Victor McCusick, a leading geneticist, decided to write an article about the history of the HeLa cell line as a tribute to Guy's career. Before writing the article, Jones pulled Henrietta's medical records to remind himself of the details of her case. When he saw the photographs of her biopsy, he immediately realized her tumor had been misdiagnosed. To be sure, he dug out the original biopsy sample, which had been stored on a shelf since 1951. In December 1971, when Jones and his colleagues published their tribute to Guy in the journal Obstetrics and Gynecology, they reported that the original pathologist had misinterpreted and mislabeled Henrietta's cancer. Her tumor was invasive, but not an epidermoid carcinoma as originally diagnosed. Rather, the article said, it was a very aggressive adenocarcinoma of the cervix, meaning it originated from glandular tissue in her cervix instead of epithelial tissue. A misdiagnosis of this type was not uncommon at the time. In 1951, the same year Jones biopsied Henrietta's tumor, researchers from Columbia University reported that the two types of cancer were easily and often confused. According to Howard Jones and other gynecologic oncologists I talked with, the correct diagnosis wouldn't have changed the way Henrietta's cancer was treated. By 1951, at least 12 studies had found that cervical adenocarcinomas and epidermoid carcinomas responded the same to radiation, which was the treatment of choice for both types. Though it wouldn't have changed Henrietta's treatment, this new diagnosis could help explain why the cancer spread throughout her body so much faster than her doctors expected. Cervical adenocarcinomas are often more aggressive than epidermoid. Her syphilis, it turns out, could have been a factor as well. Syphilis can suppress the immune system and allow cancer to spread faster than normal. Regardless, Jones and his colleagues wrote, the new diagnosis was but a footnote to the abiding genius of George Guy. It has been often said that scientific discovery results when the right man is in the right place at the right time. Guy, they said, was precisely that man. And HeLa was the result of that luck. If allowed to grow uninhibited under optimal cultural conditions, HeLa would have taken over the world by this time, they wrote. The biopsy has secured for the patient, Henrietta Lacks as HeLa, an immortality which has now reached 20 years. Will she live forever if nurtured by the hands of future workers? Even now, Henrietta Lacks, first as Henrietta and then as HeLa,
has a combined age of 51 years.
This was the first time Henrietta's real name appeared in print. Along with it, for the first time, ran the now ubiquitous photograph of Henrietta standing with her hands on her hips. The caption called her Henrietta Lacks, Hela. With that publication, Henrietta's doctor and his colleagues forever linked Henrietta, Lawrence, Sonny, Deborah, Zakaria, their children, and all future generations of Laxes to the Hela cells, and the DNA inside them. And Henrietta's identity would soon spread from lab to lab as quickly as her cells. Just 3 weeks after Henrietta's name was first published, Richard Nixon signed the National Cancer Act into law and launched the War on Cancer, designating $1.5 billion for cancer research over the next 3 years. In a move many believe was intended to distract attention from the Vietnam War, Nixon announced that scientists would cure cancer within 5 years, just in time for the United States bicentennial. With this new funding came intense political pressure for scientists to meet the president's deadline. Researchers raced to find what they believed to be the elusive cancer virus, with hopes of developing a vaccine to prevent it. And in May 1972, Nixon pledged that American and Russian scientists would work together in a biomedical exchange program to find the virus. Though much of the war on cancer hinged on research using cell cultures, few people knew that those cultures had been contaminated with Hela. A Washington Post reporter had been at the conference when Gartler announced the contamination problem. But he hadn't covered it, and most scientists were still denying that the problem existed. Some were even conducting studies aimed at disproving Gartler's findings. But the problem wasn't going to go away. Near the end of 1972, when Russian scientists claimed they'd found a cancer virus in cells from Russian cancer patients, the U.S. government had samples of the cells hand-delivered to the Naval Biomedical Research Laboratory in California for testing. It turned out those cells weren't from Russian cancer patients at all. They were from Henrietta Lacks. The man who discovered that fact was Walter Nelson Reese, a chromosome expert who was director of cell culture at the Naval Laboratory. Nelson Reese had been in the audience when Gartler presented his infamous research, and he was one of the few scientists who believed it. Nelson Reese had since been hired by the National Cancer Institute to help stop the contamination problem. He would become known as a vigilante who published Hela hit lists in Science, listing any contaminated lines he found, along with the names of researchers who'd given him the cells. He didn't warn researchers when he found that their cells had been contaminated with Hela. He just published their names, the equivalent of having a scarlet H pasted on your lab door. Despite all the evidence, most researchers still refused to believe there was a problem. And the media didn't seem to notice, until news hit that the Russian cells had been contaminated by American ones. Only then did newspapers in London, Arizona, New York, and Washington run headlines saying things like, "Cancer cells from long-dead woman invade other cultures." They reported serious confusion, misguided research, and millions of wasted dollars. Suddenly, for the first time since the Collier's article in the 50s, the press was very interested in the woman behind those cells. They wrote about her unusual kind of immortality in one article after another. They called her Helen Larson or Helen Lane, but never Henrietta Lacks, because Jones and McCusick had published her name in a small science journal few people read. Rumors spread about the identity of this mysterious Helen L. Some said she'd been Guy's secretary, or maybe his mistress. Others said she was a prostitute off the streets near Hopkins, or a figment of Guy's imagination, a fictitious character he'd created to hide the true identity of the woman behind the cells. as Helen showed up in articles again and again with different last names, a few scientists began feeling the need to set the record straight. On March 9, 1973, the journal Nature published a letter from Jay Douglas, a biologist at Brunel University. It is 21 years since George Guy established the famous HeLa cells in culture. It has been estimated that the weight of these cells in the world today exceeds that of the American Negro from whose cervical tumor they originated. That lady has achieved true immortality, both in the test tube and in the hearts and minds of scientists the world over, since the value of HeLa cells in research, diagnosis, etc. is inestimable. Yet we do not know her name. It has been widely stated that He and La are the first letters of her names, but whereas one textbook says the names were Helen Lane, another says Henrietta Lacks. My letters to the authors, inquiring the source of their information, like the letter to the hospital from which Guy's paper emanated, remain unanswered. Does anyone know for sure? Would it be contrary to medical ethics in the HeLa cells' coming-of-age year to authenticate the name and let HeLa enjoy the fame she so richly deserves? Douglas was flooded with responses. There is no record of readers addressing his question about medical ethics, but they did correct his grammar and his use of the word Negro in place of Negress. Many replies offered the names of women they believed were behind the HeLa cells: Helga Larson, Heather Langtree, even the actress Hedy Lamarr. In a follow-up letter on April 20, 1973, Douglas announced that all those women should withdraw as gracefully as they can, because he'd received a letter from Howard W. Jones that left no doubt that HeLa cells were named after Henrietta Lacks. And Jones wasn't the only one setting the record straight about Henrietta's name. Soon, Victor McCusick, one of Jones's co-authors, would send a similar letter to a reporter from Science, correcting her misuse of the name Helen Lane. In response, the journalist wrote a short follow-up article in Science titled HeLa for Henrietta Lacks. In it, she explained that she'd inadvertently repeated the lore about the origin of those cells. Then, in one of the most widely read science journals in the world, she corrected her error. Helen Lane, it seems, never lived. But Henrietta Lacks did, long protected by the pseudonym Helen Lane. She also reported that Henrietta's tumor had been incorrectly diagnosed. None of this alters the validity of the work done with HeLa cells, she wrote. But it may be worth noting, for the record. Part 3. Immortality. Chapter 23. It's Alive. 1973 to 1974. On a hazy day in 1973, in a brown brick row house 5 doors down from her own, Babette Lacks sat at her friend Gardenia's dining room table. Gardenia's brother-in-law was in town from Washington, D.C., and they'd all just finished having lunch. As Gardenia clanked dishes in the kitchen, her brother-in-law asked Babette what she did for a living. When she told him she was a patient aide at Baltimore City Hospital, he said, "Really? I work at the National Cancer Institute." They talked about medicine and gardenia's plants, which covered the windows and counters. "Those things would die in my house," Babette said, and they laughed. "Where are you from, anyway?" he asked. "North Baltimore." "No kidding. Me too. What's your last name?" "Well, it was Cooper, but my married name is Lacks."
"Your last name is Lacks?"
"Yeah? Why?"
"It's funny," he said. "I've been working with these cells in my lab for years, and I just read this article that said they came from a woman named Henrietta Lacks. I've never heard that name anywhere else.
Babette laughed.
My mother-in-law's Henrietta Lacks, but I know you're not talking about her. She's been dead almost 25 years.
Henrietta Lacks is your mother-in-law?
He asked, suddenly excited.
Did she die of cervical cancer?
Babette stopped smiling and snapped,
How'd you know that?
Those cells in my lab have to be hers, he said. They're from a black woman named Henrietta Lacks who died of cervical cancer at Hopkins in the 50s.
What?
Babette yelled, jumping up from her chair.
What do you mean you got her cells in your lab?
He held his hands up like, Whoa, wait a minute.
I ordered them from a supplier just like everybody else.
What do you mean, everybody else?
Babette snapped.
What supplier? Who's got cells from my mother-in-law?
It was like a nightmare. She'd read in the paper about the syphilis study at Tuskegee, which had just been stopped by the government after 40 years. And now, here was Gardenia's brother-in-law saying Hopkins had part of Henrietta alive, and scientists everywhere were doing research on her, and the family had no idea. It was like all those terrifying stories she'd heard about Hopkins her whole life were suddenly true and happening to her.
If they're doing research on Henrietta, she thought, it's only a matter of time before they come for Henrietta's children, and maybe her grandchildren.
Gardenia's brother-in-law told Babette that Henrietta's cells had been all over the news lately because they'd been causing problems by contaminating other cultures. But Babette just kept shaking her head and saying,
How come nobody told her family part of her was still alive? I wish I knew, he said.
Like most researchers, he'd never thought about whether the woman behind HeLa cells had given them voluntarily. Babette excused herself and ran home, bursting through the screen door into the kitchen, yelling for Lawrence.
Part of your mother? It's alive.
Lawrence called his father to tell him what Babette had heard, and Day didn't know what to think.
Henrietta's alive?
He thought. It didn't make any sense. He'd seen her body at the funeral and Clover himself.
Did they go dig it up?
Or maybe they did something to her during that autopsy. Lawrence called the main switchboard at Hopkins, saying,
I'm calling about my mother, Henrietta Lacks. You got some of her alive in there.
When the operator couldn't find a record of a patient named Henrietta Lacks in the hospital, Lawrence hung up and didn't know who else to call. Soon after Lawrence called Hopkins, in June 1973, a group of researchers gathered around a table at Yale University at the first international workshop on human gene mapping, a first step toward the Human Genome Project. They were talking about how to stop the HeLa contamination problem. When someone pointed out that the whole mess could be sorted out if they found genetic markers specific to Henrietta and used them to identify which cells were hers and which weren't. But doing that would require DNA samples from her immediate family, preferably her husband as well as her children, to compare their DNA to HeLa's and create a map of Henrietta's genes. Victor McCusick, one of the scientists who'd first published Henrietta's name, happened to be at that table. He told them he could help. Henrietta's husband and children were still patients at Hopkins, he said, so finding them wouldn't be difficult. As a physician on staff, McCusick had access to their medical records and contact information. The geneticists at the conference were thrilled. If they had access to DNA from Henrietta's children, they could not only solve the contamination problem, but also study Henrietta's cells in entirely new ways. McCusick agreed. So he turned to one of his postdoctoral fellows, Susan Hsu, and said,
As soon as you get back to Baltimore, get this done.
McCusick didn't give Hsu instructions for explaining the research to the Laxes.
All she knew was that Victor McCusick had told her to call the family.
"He was like a god," Shu told me years later. "He was a famous, famous man. He trained most of the other famous medical geneticists in the world. When Dr. McCusick said, 'You go back to Baltimore, get this blood drawn,' I did it."
When Shu got home from the conference, she called Day to ask if she could draw blood from his family.
"They said they got my wife and she part alive," he told me years later. "They said they'd been doing experiments on her, and they wanted to come test my children, see if they got that cancer killed their mother."
But Shu hadn't said anything about testing the children for cancer. There was no such thing as a cancer test, and even if there had been, McCusick's lab wouldn't have been doing one because he wasn't a cancer researcher. McCusick was a renowned geneticist who'd founded the world's first human genetics department at Hopkins, where he maintained a catalog of hundreds of genes, including several he'd discovered himself in Amish populations. He compiled information about known genes and the research done on them into a database called Mendelian Inheritance in Man, the Bible of the Field, which now was nearly 20,000 entries and is still growing. McCusick and Shu were hoping to use somatic cell hybridization to test the Lax family for several different genetic markers, including specific proteins called HLA markers. By testing Henrietta's children, they hoped to find out what Henrietta's HLA markers might have been, so they could use those to identify her cells. Shu had only recently come to America from China, and English wasn't her native language. According to Shu, when she called Day in 1973, she told him this: "We come to draw blood to get HLA androgen. We do genetic marker profile because we can deduce a lot of Henrietta Lacks genotype from the children and the husband." When I asked her if Day seemed to understand, Shu said, "They are very receptive to us when I made phone call. They are pretty intelligent. I think Mr. Lax pretty much already knew that his wife made a contribution and are very aware of the value of HeLa cells. They probably heard people talking that the cell line is such an important thing. Everybody talking about HeLa back then. They are very nice family, so they very nicely let us draw blood." Shu's accent was strong, and so was Day's. He spoke with a southern country drawl so thick his own children often had a hard time understanding him. But language wasn't their only barrier. Day wouldn't have understood the concept of immortal cells or HLA markers coming from anyone, accent or not. He'd only gone to school for 4 years of his life, and he'd never studied science. The only kind of cell he'd heard of was the kind Zakaria was living in out at Hagerstown. So he did what he'd always done when he didn't understand something a doctor said. He nodded and said yes. Years later, when I asked McCusick if anyone had tried to get informed consent from the Lax family, he said,
"I suspect there was no effort to explain anything in great detail, but I don't believe anyone would have told them they were testing for cancer because that wasn't the case. They would have just said, 'Your mother had cancer. The cells from that cancer have been growing all over the place and studied in great detail. In order to understand that better, we would like to have that blood from you people.'"
When I asked Susan Chu the same question, she said,
"No, we never gave consent form because you just go to draw blood. We are not doing some kind of medical research, you know? Not long term. All we wanted is a few tubes of blood and to do genetic marker test. It's not involved in a human research committee or things like that."
Although this attitude wasn't uncommon at the time, NIH guidelines stipulated that all human subject research funded by NIH, as McCusick's was, required both informed consent and approval from a Hopkins review board. Those guidelines had been implemented in 1966, in the aftermath of the Southam trial, and then expanded to include a detailed definition of informed consent in 1971. They were still in the process of being codified into law when Shu called Day.
McCusick began his research on the Lacks family at a time of great flux in research oversight. Just 1 year earlier, in response to Tuskegee and several other unethical studies, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, HEW, had launched an investigation into federal oversight of human subject research and found it to be inadequate. As one government report said, it was a time filled with widespread confusion about how to assess risk, as well as refusal by some researchers to cooperate with oversight, and indifference by those charged with administering research and its rules at local institutions. After halting the Tuskegee study, Hugh proposed new protection of human subjects regulations that would require, among other things, informed consent. A notice inviting public comment on that proposed new law would be published in the Federal Register in October 1973, just a few months after Hsu called Day. After Day got off the phone with Hsu, he called Lawrence, Sonny, and Deborah, saying,
"You got to come over to the house tomorrow. Doctors from Hopkins coming to test everybody's blood to see if you all got that cancer your mother had."
When Henrietta died, Day had agreed to let her doctors do an autopsy because they'd told him it might help his children someday. "They must have been telling the truth," Day thought. Zakaria was in Henrietta's womb when she first got the cancer, and he'd had all those anger problems ever since. Now, Deborah was almost 24, not much younger than Henrietta had been when she died. It made sense they were calling to say it was time for her to get tested. Deborah panicked. She knew her mother had gotten sick at 30, so she'd long feared her own 30th birthday, figuring that whatever happened to her mother at that age would happen to her, too. And Deborah couldn't stand the idea of her own children growing up motherless like she had. At that point, LaTanya was 2, Alfred was 6, and Cheetah had never paid child support. Deborah had tried welfare for 3 months but hated it. So now she was working days at a suburban Toys R Us that took more than an hour and 3 buses to get to, then nights at a hamburger place called Gino's behind her apartment. Since Deborah couldn't afford a babysitter, her boss at Gino's let Tonya and Alfred sit in the corner of the restaurant at night while Deborah worked. On her 8:30 dinner break, Deborah would run behind the building to her apartment and put the children to bed. They knew not to open the door unless they heard her secret knock, and they never put the kerosene lamps near a curtain or blanket. Deborah practiced fire drills with them in case something went wrong while she was at work, teaching them to crawl to the window, throw out a sheet rope she kept tied to the bed leg, and climb to safety. Those children were all Deborah had, and she wasn't going to let anything happen to them. So when her father called saying Hopkins wanted to test to see if she had her mother's cancer, Deborah sobbed, saying, "Lord, don't take me away from my babies. Not now. Not after everything we've been through." A few days after Susan Hsu's phone call, Day, Sonny, Lawrence, and Deborah all sat around Lawrence's dining room table as Hsu and a doctor from McCusick's lab collected tubes of blood from each of them. For the next several days, Deborah called Hopkins again and again, telling the switchboard operators, "I'm calling for my cancer results." But none of the operators knew what tests she was talking about or where to send her for help. Soon, Hsu wrote a letter to Lawrence asking if she could send a nurse out to Hagerstown to collect samples from Zakaria in prison. She included a copy of the George Guy tribute written by McCusick and Jones, saying she thought Lawrence would like to see an article about his mother's cells. No one in the family remembers reading that article. They figure Lawrence just put it in a drawer and forgot about it. The Lacks men didn't think much about their mother's cells or the cancer tests. Lawrence was working full-time on the railroad and living in a house filled with children. Zakaria was still in jail. And times had gotten tough for Sonny, who was now busy selling drugs. But Deborah couldn't stop worrying. She was terrified that she might have cancer and consumed with the idea that researchers had done and were perhaps still doing horrible things to her mother. She'd heard the stories about Hopkins snatching black people for research, and she'd read an article in Jet about the Tuskegee study that suggested doctors might have actually injected those men with syphilis in order to study them. The injection of disease-causing organisms into unaware human subjects has occurred before in American medical science, the article explained. It was done 8 years ago in New York City by Dr. Chester Southam, a cancer specialist who injected live cancer cells into chronically ill elderly patients. Deborah started wondering if, instead of testing the Lax children for cancer, McCusick and Hsu were actually injecting them with the same bad blood that had killed their mother. She started asking Day a lot of questions about Henrietta. How'd she get sick? What happened when she died? What did those doctors do to her? The answers seemed to confirm her fears. Day told her that Henrietta hadn't seemed sick at all. He said he took her into Hopkins, they started doing treatments, then her stomach turned black as coal and she died. Sadie said the same thing, and so did all the other cousins. But when she asked what kind of cancer her mother had, what treatments the doctor gave her, and what part of her was still alive, the family had no answers. So when one of McCusick's assistants called Deborah and asked her to come into Hopkins to give more blood, she went, thinking that if her family couldn't answer questions about her mother, maybe the scientists could. She didn't know the blood was for a researcher in California who wanted some samples for his own HeLa research, and she didn't know why McCusick's assistant was calling her and not her brothers. She figured it was because the problem her mother had didn't affect boys. She still thought she was being tested for cancer. Deborah went into McCusick's office to give more blood on June 26, 1974, 4 days before the new federal law went into effect requiring IRB approval and informed consent for all federally funded research. The new law, published in the Federal Register 1 month earlier, applied to all subjects at risk, meaning any individual who may be exposed to the possibility of injury, including physical, psychological, or social injury, as a consequence of participation as a subject. But what constituted injury and risk was heavily debated. Numerous researchers had appealed to Hsu, asking that collection of blood and tissues be exempt from the new law. After all, doctors had been drawing blood for centuries for diagnostic testing.